This is James Corbett of the Corbett Report, and once again I'm talking to Marcia Reed, the managing editor of geopoliticalmonitor.com, for our monthly update from Geopolitical Monitor. Marcia Reed, well, Happy New Year, and it's good to have you back on the program.
Happy New Year to you as well, and I'm glad to be back.
All right. What would you like to talk about this month?
Well, there's two issues I wanted to talk about, and they're diametrically opposed in terms of geopolitical ramifications and significance and coverage. And the first issue, which everyone has been following, I'm sure, is the situation in Israel and the Palestinian territories, particularly Israel's offensive in Gaza. And then the second situation that I think needs to be given more coverage is actually Mexico. And that's in relation to a recent U.S. Army report that Mexico, more so than Pakistan, could be a potential failed state. So those are two issues I wanted to actually touch upon in our interview.
All right. Well, very, very interesting topic. So let's get straight into it. What can you tell us about the Gaza situation that the controlled corporate media hasn't been telling us?
Well, the thing that's interesting about the Gaza situation is that when you look at the coverage of what's been happening, a lot of emphasis has talked about, has been on, obviously, religious, ethnic tensions between Arab states and Israel as a Jewish state. As well, we've talked a lot about, or the media has talked a lot about, political implications in terms of Fatah having elections, or the Palestinian territories having elections coming next month, and in Israel there's elections coming next month, and so appealing to the more right-wing factions of the populations that this offensive would be politically expedient for both respective political parties in Israel and in the Palestinian territories. But what has gone under the radar in terms of coverage of this event is the issue of gas, of natural gas. And what we have is a situation where you could feasibly argue that the whole motivation, or one of the bigger motivations behind this conflict, has been control of natural gas supply. Now, in the media, there's been a few reports that have gone largely unnoticed, which I find very interesting, about a key offshore natural gas supply off of the Gaza coast. And back in 1999, so this is about 10 years ago, there was discovery of a natural gas field, or the Gaza Marine Gas Field, off of the Gaza coast, about 36 kilometers off the Gaza coast. And in 1999, BG, which is a British group, and its partner, Consolidated Corporation, they paid the Palestinian authorities an undisclosed sum so that they could actually survey the area to find out how much, if any, natural gas was in that particular area. And so I think it was about 1,000 square kilometers in area that they were going to do this concession to survey for natural gas. And they discovered that there was quite a large quantity of gas, about $4 billion worth of natural gas in that particular area. And so they sort of hammered out this agreement that the British natural gas surveyor, BG, would receive about 60% from sales of gas, and then its partner, Consolidated Corporation, received 30%, and the Palestinian Authority would receive 10% of the royalties for any future sales of gas. And the sales of gas would actually be targeted for Israel. So this was the sort of general foundation for an agreement for the natural gas in that particular area. But the thing that's problematic is that at the time when this was discovered, 1999, Fatah was in control of the Palestinian Authority. And they're a more secular, moderate political group compared to Hamas, which is obviously a more Islamist and hardline group. So at the time this was going on, Fatah was in control of the Palestinian Authority. And so over the course of the next few years, since 1999 to probably about 2006, BG and its partner, CC, Consolidated Corporation, were trying to hammer out a, I guess, a kind of final deal with Israel with regards to transporting gas or pumping gas to the Jewish state. But they hadn't really agreed on a particular price. Now, what makes this even more interesting is that about 2006, 2007, when they were still trying to hammer out a particular price for this contract, we had a scenario or a situation in the Palestinian territories where Hamas won parliamentary elections. And so they were now effectively in control of the Palestinian territories. But since Hamas, obviously, it being an enemy of the Israeli state, or not recognizing the Israeli state and its armed wing, the Al-Qassam Brigades, firing rockets and, I guess, engaging in suicide attacks in Israel, Israel was having no part of this. It wasn't going to continue this deal where 10% of royalties would go to Hamas, which is now controlling the Palestinian authorities. So the deal sort of fell apart. And so Israel tried to actually bypass the deal and have the gas pumped to them through an underground or a pipeline under the sea to Ashkelon in Israel. And so they actually completely bypass giving any proceeds of the sales to the Palestinian authorities. And so BG was trying to hammer out a deal and still nothing was finalized. So now you fast forward to 2008, 2009, where the deal still hadn't been finalized, nothing was in the works, BG sort of backed out, the gas fields remain unsurveyed or untouched, and there's conflict between Hamas and Fatah over control of the Palestinian territories, and then Hamas and Israel with their rocket attacks. So the Israel ostensibly is now committed this offensive, or committed itself to this offensive, by the end of 2008, ostensibly because of Hamas's rocket attacks. However, it's sort of interesting that, based on reports that Israel had actually planned this invasion of the Gaza Strip 6 months prior. So, for example, the invasion happened in December, but there's reports that from June, Israel was planning this invasion of Gaza, yet simultaneously engaging in negotiations for a ceasefire. That sort of raises questions as to how genuine Israel was in sort of engaging in any peace with Hamas, or at least hammering out some kind of tenable peace. So in the backdrop, you have this unfinished gas deal going on, and Israel is in desperate need of gas supplies and receiving gas. And so one could argue that the whole idea was to go into Gaza and, under the ruse of ending these rocket attacks and arms smuggling, actually topple Hamas and then bring back Fatah into power to then renegotiate this deal that they had started years before when they finally just, when they had first discovered the gas fields. So it's quite an interesting development that hasn't been touched upon, that against all of this discussion of stopping rocket attacks and arms smuggling, in fact, one could argue that the motivation was to continue this deal in terms of, you know, securing a gas supply for the next decade and a half to 2 decades.
That is an absolutely fascinating take on the whole situation, and one that I think plays into things that we've discussed in our previous conversations about the absolute crucial importance of energy and access to resources in a lot of geopolitical maneuvering. So it definitely falls into line with that analysis. But just to make sure that I understand correctly, it sounds like you're saying that if Israel were able to secure a different route for the gas, they would actually be able to bypass having to pay any of the proceeds to the Palestinian Authority. Is it just based on whether the gas is actually going through the Palestinian Authority, or does the Palestinian Authority actually have any claims to the natural gas because it lies off the territorial waters of Gaza?
Well, it's the latter. It's that Palestinian authorities have claims to that in terms of international law and recognition of the claims that Gaza has. It is an Israeli territory, but what Israel wanted to do was they wanted to completely when I say bypass, I don't mean physically bypass, but just altogether avoid giving any funds to the Palestinian Authority, because instead of Fatah being in place, it was now Hamas, and Israel didn't want to do any business or give any funds to Hamas to fund terrorism or any more suicide attacks or just any of Hamas's ideological aims. And then the VG group couldn't do business with Hamas because it's been classified as a terrorist organization by many countries, the EU, Canada, United States, UK. And doing business with a terrorist organization is obviously, for those governments, would be illegal. So it was just a matter of Israel just blatantly saying, well, we're not going to be paying for any gas from Palestinians. I think it was Ariel Sharon who said that statement. I think it was 2006 he'd said, we're not paying for any gas from the Palestinians. So it was just a matter of pragmatically saying, well, let's continue with this deal, especially since we have Hamas now in power. Because keep in mind that Israel was wanting to hammer in a deal very quickly because they knew the political situation was very tenuous in the Palestinian territories, what with the schism between Hamas and Fatah and the unrest and that civil war that happened in Gaza between the two different political parties. So for Israel, it was a matter of saying, let's just continue on with this deal. And what they wanted to do was create this pipeline that would go directly to Israel. I think with Fatah, I don't have any details on that. I'm assuming that they still would have continued dealing with a pipeline, but they just would have given 10% of the proceeds from the sales to the Palestinian Authority. But seeing that the political situation had changed and that Hamas was not, or Fatah was not able to oust Hamas in that failed attempt, I think it was a year later, 2007, to oust them out of the Gaza Strip, Israel had even more incentives to try and find any alternative to secure this gas supply. So one could argue then that having exhausted all its different alternatives or, different, ways of dealing with the situation, they decided, well, under the pretext of getting rid of the threat of Hamas from its rocket attacks and arms smuggling, we can go into the Gaza Strip, change the political situation on the ground, and maybe negotiate some kind of different territorial boundaries or further entrench our blockade, and then, ostensibly to the public legitimately deal with this issue of securing the gas. But at the time, it was just a matter of, blatantly disregarding the political determination of the Palestinian people by saying, well, Hamas is not legitimate, we're not dealing with them. Let's deal with this pipeline. If it was Fatah, we'd still deal with the pipeline, but we'd give you 10% of the proceeds as was agreed originally in 1999. So that's what the situation boiled down to.
I see. So is there any particular reason for the timing of this attack? Did it have to happen at this particular time, or was it just something that Israel wanted to have happen sooner or later?
I don't think that it had to happen at this particular time. I think that the ceasefire running out was a great pretext for Israel to launch this offensive. Why would they be planning, for example, in June 2008, there was people from within the ministry, defense ministry, saying that Ehud Olmert had started planning for this Operation Cast Lead. And yet June 2008 was when Israel was ironing out the details on a ceasefire, a six-month ceasefire with Hamas. So one could argue that Hamas is always continually firing rockets into Israel, and the arms smuggling is an issue. One could argue that having that ceasefire run out, Israel could then say, well, the ceasefire's run out, Hamas is still posing a threat. We really have to do something. It's politically expedient for various right-wing parties to appeal to their hawkish voters. So it's a win-win situation in that politically, for those hawkish right-wing parties, appealing to Israelis who really feel that something has to be done about Hamas, it's a success on that front. And then also, it's an opportunity to finally go in and sort of wrap up this deal on the gas reserves. Now, another thing that's quite interesting is that the timing of the ceasefire in January 18th, after this three-week offensive, it just sort of seemed to stop suddenly when most people thought that Operation Cast Lead would continue on to more ground battle between the Israeli Defense Forces and the Hamas militants. But then it was sort of strange that Ehud Olmert said, well, we are going to engage in this unilateral ceasefire and we'll pull our troops out of the Gaza Strip. Some people said it was Israel caving to international pressure. But it's interesting that a day after the ceasefire was announced, Israel announced that they had discovered gas supplies, or an offshore gas supply of their own, off their own northern coast. So that's another interesting development that hasn't really been talked about as much either. And it's a larger gas field than the one discovered off of the Gaza Strip. So this is off of Haifa, I believe, in Israel. They've discovered this gas field, and it's much larger. So it's interesting that they announced the ceasefire, and then a day later, oh, we've discovered our own gas field.
That is very interesting. So how do you see that playing into the current situation, and where do you think things might unfold from here?
I think the ceasefire is obviously very tenuous, and I really don't think it's going to last. I mean, it hasn't lasted. I mean, we've seen just this week with Hamas firing more rockets and Israel retaliating and violence breaking out sporadically. But I think that for Israel, I mean, one could argue, if you're going to focus particularly on the situation with the gas reserves, that this discovery of their own gas field must come as a huge relief in terms of, supplying an energy source for the next decade, two decades, long-term energy source. I think they're still going to obviously push for some kind of agreement whereby the proceeds of the sale from the gas reserve off of the Gaza Strip will not be able to go in any way, shape, or form to Hamas. That is something that they will definitely fight for, just because of the huge amount of money made off of these sales. We're talking about billions of dollars. And imagine billions of dollars in the hands of Hamas for Israel. That is a very horrible and terrifying thought. So this is something as well that Israel will continue to push for. I don't really see the situation changing much, in the sense that there's no way Israel can somehow bring Fatah back into the Gaza Strip at all. Hamas is, I think, emerged from the situation actually quite victorious, in the sense that despite the huge amount of casualties, they're still able to fire rockets into Israel. They're still going to be able to somehow bypass any of the border crossings or the controls of the borders, and are going to be able to have arms smuggled in. They're going to gain more supporters. So in that sense, the situation is a lot tougher for Israel and a lot worse. So I don't know. It's really tricky to say how far Israel is going to go in terms of, getting access or control of this gas field in Gaza. Some people say that it could be used as a bargaining chip in the ceasefire, that Hamas is actually really suffering, and that, they'll let go of the 10% of the sales in exchange for some other concessions. But I don't know. I don't know if Hamas is actually as battered as people would like to think they are. So Israel is definitely going to focus on more surveying of their own gas fields, and at the same time, through measures with the EU and the US, in terms of, they've had a pact that Israel signed, I think, just a couple of Fridays ago with the United States to control or stop arms smuggling and rearmament of Hamas. So I think on that end, that's what they're going to try and do, and limit it to that. But it's really such a very murky situation that's developing quickly day by day, that it's hard to really state definitively what's going to happen with these gas fields. I mean, in terms of international law, it's not Israeli gas field. These are Palestinian gas fields. It's a matter of who is this money going to go to, this 10%, if this deal gets hammered through. Is it going to somehow go to Fatah, which is a more secular and moderate group? Are they going to be able to somehow bypass the fact that Hamas is in firm control of Gaza? That's really hard to imagine. So it's just a matter of, obviously it's not a very good prediction to say wait and see, but this is actually a situation where you have to really wait and see what happens in the next couple of weeks. And it'll be interesting to see if the media picks up on this. People might say, I haven't heard anything about this. This sounds far-fetched. This is some kind of, forced conspiracy theory, or this is just maybe a coincidence. But I really don't think so. It just doesn't add up or make sense that Israel would suddenly declare ceasefire and then a day later announce their discovery of their own gas fields, and, you know, prior to that, plan for 6 months ahead in advance, you know, this entire offensive, when at the same time they were supposed to be hammering out ceasefire. So these are all various things that people have to really look at and pay attention to that are lurking beneath the surface of these more reported issues.
All right. Well, we certainly will be keeping our eye on that and see how that develops in the coming weeks. But switching gears now, what can you tell us about Mexico and its potential status as a failed state?
Oh, yes. Mexico is another situation that I find really interesting because there's not really been much said about it by the international community or in the media, because everyone's been focusing naturally on the situation in Gaza. But there is a U.S. Army report released just a couple of weeks ago that said that Mexico was on track to being a failed state, that it could happen very suddenly, very quickly, because of the influence of drug cartels and police corruption. So in 2008, I think about over 5,000 people were killed from violence due to drug trafficking and drug cartels. And it's been problematic because there are key drug cartels that are increasingly powerful. Police corruption is rampant, and this naturally is a concern for the United States with regards to border security between the Mexican and U.S. border. So the United States Army is saying this is problematic. There's been kidnappings, beheadings, bodies being dissolved in acid, people disappearing. It's just a really horrible situation that if you were to just talk about it without mentioning which country it's in, people might think this is Pakistan, where beheadings and kidnappings frequently happen, or in Iraq. But this is happening in Mexico. So drug trafficking is a really big problem, and the United States has committed itself to fighting this war on drugs by engaging in this bilateral initiative, the Merida Initiative, also known as Plan Mexico by its critics. And calling it Plan Mexico is a reference to Plan Colombia, which I'm sure people might know about. If they don't, Plan Colombia was an initiative between the United States and Colombia to combat drug trafficking, but it sort of, lost its original intent, and the money that was used for drug trafficking actually funded the military to fight any indigenous groups and dissidents and FARC rebels. So it was sort of a broader tool for the United States to help Colombia consolidate its right-wing government and American hegemony in the region. So people are saying that Plan Mexico is going to be a repeat of Plan Colombia. It's going to do little to stop the war on drugs. It's going to actually exacerbate the problem, create more instability, militarize Mexico. And the fact that all this money, about $1.4 billion, is being given to the Mexican military, which is already corrupt, and the police forces, which are already corrupt and committing human rights abuses, is problematic. It's like adding fuel to the fire. It's not really going to stop anything or change the situation on the ground. Another thing that's problematic about Plan Mexico is that, aside from providing $1 billion to the Mexican military and police forces, which suffer from corruption, and as well funding the U.S. military industrial complex, because a lot of this money goes towards buying weapons and equipment from the U.S. military, like helicopters and intelligence or surveillance monitors. Anything that deals with drug interdiction is going to be bought from the U.S. military industrial complex. So aside from half of that money going to those two groups, the problem is that this money isn't really preventing any of the drug trafficking or really stopping the drug market, because it's not acknowledging the U.S. complicity in this problem. The fact that the U.S. has the largest drug market in the world in terms of demand for drugs. The fact that U.S. border agents accept bribes, and the fact that the United States hasn't really acknowledged its role in fueling or feeding the drug trade due to such high demand. This isn't to blame the United States entirely for problems that have happened in Mexico, but it's just to say it doesn't acknowledge the complicity of the United States in the success of drug cartels because of the high demand for cocaine and for marijuana and other drugs that are being consumed. So Plan Mexico, which started in was actually passed in 2008 by the U.S. Congress, has really been criticized heavily for all of these issues and the fact that it's a pretext for, well, for Bush at the time being the president, a pretext for him to consolidate American hegemony in Latin America, because Mexico and Colombia are the only right-wing governments in Latin America, or conservative governments, sorry, that are friendly and pro-U.S. You have Venezuela, Cuba, Bolivia, Ecuador, all very left-wing socialist governments. And so Plan Mexico, like Plan Colombia, would be an opportunity under the guise of fighting the war on drugs to increase American hegemony or American influence in the region. So this is just sort of an overview of Plan Colombia and what's problematic about it, how it's not really going to necessarily stop Mexico from being a failed state or prevent Mexico from collapsing. It might just worsen the situation. So that's the situation I think people have really not heard much about, and they should pay closer attention to it, since, you know, being the fact that this is, you know, we're in North America, or many listeners are in North America, this is something that's right in their backyard. So this is another issue that's gone under the radar.
Absolutely. And just to back up what you're saying, something that we talked about in a previous interview, actually with Nico of geopoliticalmonitor.com, was a June 26, 1999 Reuters article, which talked about Dick Grasso, who was the head of the New York Stock Exchange, who visited Colombia in 1999 to visit the FARC to implore them to invest their obviously illicit drug money in the New York Stock Exchange. When that deal didn't quite work out, the next year Plan Colombia came out, and Washington was heavily funding attempts to get rid of the FARC. So there's no doubt that there's all sorts of U.S. Involvement in the region, and also, of course, caught up in the drug trade in various ways. So, yeah, that absolutely plays into exactly what's happening in Mexico right now, and undoubtedly any funds for Plan Mexico will also be playing political favorites to try to garner U.S. Hegemony in the region.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, this is that's why I'm sort of astounded at the fact that it hasn't really received a lot of media coverage. I mean, I understand that, you know, there's been a lot of big news in terms of Obama becoming president, and everyone's looking to see what he's doing next. And then we have the situation in Gaza, which has really received a lot of attention. But I mean, this has been a long festering problem. This is not something that's happened overnight. This is something that's been going on for a long time. And the war on drugs has always been, you know, something that U.S. administrations have tried to tackle through the military. And that's exactly what's problematic, is that, you know, you're sort of making economic or social issues national security issues, which is very dangerous to do, because then it stifles any democratic institutions and any social, social checks and balances on and what's going on with regards to dealing with drug trafficking. To have the military come in entirely, you know, deal with the situation, just allows for, you know, drug cartels to actually become stronger, because you take one out and another one's going to come in its place, and it creates turf wars, and there isn't really any accountability to democratic institutions when you have corrupt police forces and corrupt army officers involved in getting rid of a problem that they're a part of. I mean, the head of the Mexico's Interpol was actually involved in drug trafficking, and a lot of high-ranking army officers have been involved in drug trafficking as well in Mexico. On the other side, though, in the United States has failed to acknowledge, like we've been saying, its own complicity in this problem and casting it solely as a Mexican problem, when there's been such a huge demand for drugs in the United States. And so Mexico is just feeding that supply. So this is something that really needs to be given further thought. the fact that the United States military could intervene in Mexico if something like a sudden, you know, government collapse occurred is something that people should think about. This is not to fearmonger and, you know, tell people to worry about Mexico or be wary of Mexican immigrants flooding the southwestern U.S. because of the collapse of their state. But this is just something that needs to also be acknowledged in the broader scheme of what's going on, you know, internationally. I mean, all eyes have been towards the Middle East or resurgent Russia or Iran's nuclear program, but sometimes it's the kind of slowly festering problems in our own backyard that sometimes catch us unawares, and we need to just acknowledge that what's happening is quite serious, and just because it's not as sort of as explosive or fast-paced as something like the offensive in Gaza or, you know, nuclear programs doesn't mean it's any less relevant or important.
That's absolutely right. And I think a good place for people to start looking into the issue and thinking about the implications of U.S. funding Mexican military and police would be to take a look at the riots and the teacher protests in Oaxaca, Mexico in 2006, where actually a U.S. journalist, Brad Will, died helping to cover that teacher strike in Oaxaca, Mexico. And of course, flagrant human rights abuses by the Mexican military and police in pursuit of their war on terror and, of course, their war on drugs. And of course, we know a lot of corruption and abuse comes out of that. So yes, definitely a very important story that hasn't received a lot of mainstream press coverage. Again, some very interesting analysis tonight, Marcia. Thank you again for all of that analysis. Why don't you tell us a little bit more about geopoliticalmonitor.com?
Well, geopoliticalmonitor.com is a really great source for alternative news and events that are happening around the world. We have analysis, we have backgrounders, we do forecasting, and we have audio podcasts as well, so people can hear or listen to our forecasts instead of just reading them. But it's a really great site that people should visit if they want to find any news that sort of is under the radar. A lot of times we cover stories that the mainstream media will cover days later and consider breaking news when in fact we've covered it a few days before. So it's really a great source for people to be on the up and up in terms of any groundbreaking or fast developing events. And our analysis as well is really great. We have a lot of good coverage, good writers. I'd highly recommend people visit the site.
Absolutely. Lots of great free information available. Also, there's a subscription available to the Geopolitical Monitor. What comes with a subscription?
Well, with the subscription, you get, as I mentioned, we had audio. So with this subscription, you have access to our backgrounders. You have access to our situation reports where we do in-depth analysis, and as well listening to the audio of our forecast that we have. Our weekly forecast come out every Monday morning. So they have a monthly subscription, yearly subscription, and we recommend everyone come to the site at geopoliticalmonitor.com. To check out our content and decide if they're subscribing, what kind of subscription they'd like to make to the site.
Absolutely. And I'd also like to remind my listeners to enter the coupon code JCorbett, JCORBETT, while you're subscribing in order to receive a discount to a yearly subscription and also to help fund the Corbett Report podcast. All right, Marcia Reed, once again, excellent analysis. Thank you very much, and I'm looking forward to talking to you again in the coming year.
Thanks a lot. Thanks for having me.
No problem.